This is the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelzer, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto of the National Speleological Society. Welcome. This is a monthly podcast about caves, cave exploration, and cave conservation. And the NSS is a national organization dedicated to just those things. If you're here for the first time, or maybe you've been listening to a few of these and you've never gone caving before, but you're interested, I would encourage you to find your local grotto. That's a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. Attend some meetings, meet some cavers who can show you where to go and how to do it right. Caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, so get some education, make some new friends. Speaking of the NSS, if you've started to get involved in caving, maybe you've gone caving with some people, but you haven't attended any grotto meetings, or maybe you've joined a grotto but haven't yet joined the NSS. I know our grotto asks members to become NSS members within a year of joining the grotto. I don't know how other grottos do it, but that's how we do it. The NSS is, of course, our national organization, and like so many nonprofits across the country these days, membership is down and falling, and the budget is tight. Lately, there's been some discussion online as to the benefits of membership and sharing ideas on how the organization can attract new members or somehow make more money. And there have been some good ideas, constructive comments. And as a grotto chairman, I appreciate the exchange of good ideas and plan on implementing some of them at my grotto. And as in any situation online, when public comments are allowed, there have been some less constructive comments about the perceived lack of benefits of membership. And normally I wouldn't respond to such comments because there's always going to be those people who say those things online. But it comes down to this. When you join the NSS or when you pay your annual dues, what you're doing is you're declaring in a loud voice that you care about caves, whether it's the study of caves, the exploration of caves, the conservation of karst environments. Whether you feel you directly benefit from membership is irrelevant. I mean, you join a nonprofit because you care about what they're devoted to. That's the benefit. You're paying into an organization that takes care of something that you care about. So I encourage you to join. Or if you've let your membership lapse, I'll admit it, I've done that too in years past, you can renew it now at the NSS website, caves.org. Caves.org. Easy to remember. Or if you're already a member and you've always thought about making that big donation in addition to your annual dues, got some extra cash in the bank, there's never been a better time to do so. Thanks for listening. I'll hop off the soapbox now. Greg McNamara is my guest this month. We'll get to him in just a second. First, I want to thank my sponsor, Organic Robot, on Etsy, maker of some of the best caving and outdoor-themed shirts you can find anywhere. Charlie is a board member in my grotto, the CIG, and he's a hell of a designer and a hell of a caver. His designs have won awards at the NSS Salon. He's set up shop at CIRA, OTR, our event, Indiana Cave Capers, and other great caving conventions. And if you've missed those events and you want to see what he's got to offer, just Google Organic Robot, all one word, Organic Robot, and click the Etsy link. Many of his unique designs are available on synthetic moisture-wicking fabrics, and they're always a hit. I especially love his Eat, Sleep, Cave, Repeat shirt. Gotta get that one. Support a caver-owned business at Organic Robot on Etsy. And a reminder, as of last month, the Caving Podcast is on Patreon. Patreon is a way you can directly financially support the podcast with either a one-time contribution or with a monthly contribution. And every dollar that comes in via Patreon will go right back into the caving community. Initially, I'm going to focus it all on memberships and donations to conservancies. If everyone who listened to this podcast gave just a dollar a month, $12 a year, that's less than most grotto memberships, that would mean around $1,000 a month that would go right back into caving. Now, wouldn't that be nice? But I know it's not going to happen. I would really love, though, a single-digit fraction of that at least. That'd be nice. You can charge it to a credit card where you wouldn't even miss it. You won't even notice it. And you can be sure that by supporting the podcast, you're not just paying my bills, you're paying for caving. Visit patreon.com/cavingpodcast. patreon.com/cavingpodcast. And thank you. Okay, thanks for sitting through all that. Stay tuned after this month's episode to find out who I got for next month. I don't always know who's coming up, but I've banked up a couple interviews, and so I know we've got some really exciting guests coming up. This month's guest is a caver I've admired since I first joined the CIG because he's been there forever, and he actually talked to me and welcomed me like I mattered from day one. It goes to show you can really make a big impact on new members by just being welcoming and encouraging when they first start showing up to meetings. He's a hell of a caver, been involved in project caving in Indiana, Kentucky, down in Tag, Mexico, and elsewhere for 40 years now. And despite his humility, which I love about him, I did get him talking about some of the coolest places he's been and his accomplishments in the caving world. He won our big award this year, Caver of the Year, at our annual event, Indiana Cave Capers, and he's just one of the nicest people on the planet. I was honored to have Greg McNamara on the podcast. Greg McNamara, welcome to the Caving Podcast.
Thanks, Matt. It's great to be here. I appreciate it.
I have in front of me, now, normally we just kind of, with these interviews, I just kind of ask questions and we go from there. But with you, I wanted to put you on the spot. And all I apologize in advance. You and I have talked about this before, but I wonder if you could just read the opening paragraph to your two-bit pit entry, which is featured in the 2007 National Convention book.
Well, that's might be a tough one.
Do you remember when you wrote that? Well, okay, just go ahead and read it first.
All right. Two-bit pit is synonymous with adjectives like tough, tight, cold, sleazy, long, and arduous, to name a few. Not many caves in the Midwest carry such a reputation, and two-bit pit is a testimony to what sport caving is all about. Besides being one of Indiana's deepest caves at 253 feet total vertical depth, it is also one of the most demanding in terms of mental and physical stamina. It is without a doubt a caver's cave, featuring every imaginable challenge one would care to embrace. But at the same time, it is a cave that offers rewards for those who venture into its depths, a spiritual place where solitude and inner strength are in equilibrium.
Can I just tell you, thank you, first of all, for reading that. So can I just tell you how much that article that came after that and that paragraph influenced my caving life?
Well, that's great. I would have never guessed.
I borrowed this book before I became an NSS member. You can only buy this book, Back Underground in Indiana, the 2007 National Convention Guidebook. I borrowed this book from Paul Uglum after I took my first couple trips with him and I started getting interested. And he said, I got a couple books I could let you see. And he gave me that one in the 92 guidebook. And I was reading all these articles and I saw that one and I thought, I don't know if I want to go there, but I want to hang out with that guy and I want to know more about Two-Bit Pit and where he's been, because that was just, that opening paragraph to me was just so poetic. And I think I and a lot of the listeners have been in that place where, you know, you go caving for a number of reasons, but in reading that and in hearing that, it just, I don't know, I pick up from you that it's kind of a spiritual thing.
Yeah, it was a real honor to be able to write an article for a guidebook, a convention guidebook, and being involved in Two-Bit, it just flowed, you know, from, I don't know, I probably had between 10 and 15 trips in Two-Bit over the years, and just got a really a great amount of inner peace by going in there, and everything I needed, it satisfied.
Do you know when you wrote that? You know about when that was? Mid-90s? Was it? Because I know you were exploring in the early 90s, right? You found it in the early 90s or late 80s or something like that, right?
Correct.
And so you wrote that maybe about that time, or did you write that as to kind of a, because you kind of compiled a number of brief trip summaries for this article that appeared in the 2007 book.
Right. Those were from my log that I had kept over the years, but I wrote the article right before. Before the convention guidebook was put together. So oh. I don't, was that 2007 then?
2007, yeah.
So it was probably in there. So I was going off my notes and memory, whatever I have left.
In reading that, and if you've got a copy of the 2007, you the listener, the 2007 guidebook, I would recommend reading that because it's incredible to me. Like I said, I don't know if I want to go there. And as it turns out, I couldn't now because it's on state land, right?
Correct.
It's in southern Indiana in the Harrison Crawford State Forest. And since then, the state caves have been closed. But I don't know if I'd want to go there, but I am curious about that cave. And we'll get to your general caving life here in a little bit. But that cave to me sounds like a real sporty mess, like some really tight spots and some, I mean, if you were injured in the lower levels, I mean, you'd be completely screwed.
I think you would. Yep. Just beyond the bottom of the third drop is where the tight canyon starts off. It's maybe 100 or 200 feet long, but it's pretty challenging.
Takes what, like 2 hours to get through, something like that?
Yeah, maybe an hour when you're have been going in and out as many times, and you learn where to move, you know, where to go high, low, you know, all the tricks to get through the canyon. But
and it's trending downward too, right? So you got to kind of, I mean, do you pick whether to go head first or feet first, or can you do either? Do you have to go head first?
It's pretty much like a kind of a crawl in a canyon. And you're working your way up and down throughout the canyon in the widest place.
Wow.
To get through. And then once you get through that, then you have three more drops. And all the drops are very gritty, sleazy, muddy type drops. Yeah. And then you get down to the very long 1,700-foot water crawl Neptune's Retreat. And then you break into the big stuff, which... is very similar to Binkley's back in the McLean, where the water is waist deep and the mud is knee deep underneath the water. So it's really a tough trip.
If you've got the 2007 book, check it out, because there's a picture that kind of illustrates this canyon. I believe there's two canyons, right? The Terminator and the Exterminator. Is that
yeah,
kind of what they were named?
Two different tough areas, especially tough areas, the Terminator and the Exterminator, right?
There's, I think, a color picture in the back of the book of Brian Killingbeck negotiating it without his helmet on, because you can't really do it with a helmet on, right? Certain parts of it?
Correct, yes.
And it's just, I mean, for some people, I've shown it to people who are not cavers, and they're like, that looks like a nightmare.
Well, Brian didn't seem to think it was too bad, but, depends on what your level of caving is, I guess, you know, so... but really, I don't know how long I'd last in there these days. I still could fit, I'm sure, but it'd just be it's something you just have to work your way up to, and then as you keep going in over and over again, it's almost like it's an inviting thing to go back into it when you know you can have mastery over it.
So, do you think you pushed that cave as far as it would go?
There's still some leads in there that we never finished when we were mapping, and then people just did different things, started moving out, and, you know, never got back in there. But there's some upper-level areas that need mapping and exploring still.
That bottom, the lower level that just kind of went all one way and then the other, I mean, that looked like it went a long way.
Yeah, I believe it's a mile and a half down in the lower levels, the water. And we checked that really well. We checked every side lead, you know, pretty good. So I think any of the stuff that to be found is probably above the sixth drop, somewhere in between the fourth and sixth drop. There's some areas in there.
Yeah, there's a line plot map in the 2007 book. And it just, you know, when you look at it, there's a, you know, the horizontal, of course, and then there's the vertical, where it's just like, you know, you start at the top, you do the few drops, and then there's some other, you know, spidery things, and then you just go down to the very bottom, and then it's just all the way one way and all the way the other. You must have hit a certain spot in the rock where it's just underground rivers all over the place.
Yeah, I think
through there.
Potato Run.
Yeah,
you know?
Potato Run.
Yep, yeah, it should keep going, but, you know.
When was the last time you were in there?
Probably 91, I'm guessing. 91,
yeah,
I think. Yeah, about the time Chris Yeager passed away, I don't think we had any more trips after that.
I don't know if I'm familiar with Chris.
Yeah, he was in our group, and we called him the kid because he was 7-8 years younger than most of us. And he actually was killed in Mexico in a cave exploration accident.
That's
in
right.
Cueva Cheve in 91.
I've heard about that, yeah. Man.
He was a great guy, and we've been friends with his mom and dad since that happened. Still to this day, we see him all the time, and so they kind of gained a family with the loss of their son, as far as the caving community goes. So, great,
that's good.
Great people. Though.
Yeah, I'm sure they needed some emotional support after that, and you guys stepped in. That's good for you.
Well, yeah, they provided it for us too.
I guess, having talked about 2-bit pit, I guess what I want to know is, what are some of the sleaziest, grimmest spots you've ever been in your caving life? Because I know people who have gone caving and they just go recreational caving. And then I know some people who like to go easier caving. You've done some hard stuff. And you've been caving, what, 40 years, 45 years?
40 years.
40 years.
Yes.
And you're pretty much mostly a project caver. And so you've seen some stuff. In your memory, what is some of the craziest places you've ever found yourself in?
Well, it seems like a lot of the caves that I go into are that kind of cave. They're sleazy caves, stuff that nobody wants to go in, and you find there's always something down the worst passage, you know, you would never want to go in, you know. And and so, I think 2-bit is sleazy in places, but I'd say Dewey Eckert and Binkley system has some really pretty nasty stuff in there, but it's all great, you know. It's just a small price to pay for finding the booty.
That's true. And you found some booty in Dewey Eckert. I mean, you connected it to Binkley, and it's a cave that's unlike a lot of Binkley, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's completely different. Basically, it's I think Guy Stover Cave is another cave that was connected into Binkley, and it's very muddy and dry upper level, and that's kind of what Dewey is also. It's the same type of thing, an upper level paleo passage from the abandoned riverway, I guess. But yeah, I was very fortunate to get involved with Ran Hazlett and Shane Miles and all the ISS cavers, and Marion Akers got our group kind of going in that direction, and it's been a blast to cave with these folks and to be part of that.
I guess I should tell you, I should tell the listeners that you are Caver of the Year 2017 at Indiana Cave Capers, and that came about from a paper letter, which you don't see very much of these days. Most of the time we communicate via email, but this was a paper letter in a sealed envelope that I got at a grotto meeting, that was the first nomination for you as Caver of the Year. And I got it in February or March, I believe, months before Capers. And I thought, okay, all right. And then I got more electronically via Facebook and via email, nominating you. And it was all from the Dewey Eckert work.
Well, maybe I should have got involved in that a long time ago, but I'm very honored to start with, because great standing with all these other cavers that have been Caver of the Year in the past, and I'm just very fortunate. Just keep caving and try to keep the intensity up, the same level of caving over the 40 years, and I guess they're feeling sorry for me, and better give it to him before he kicks a bucket. So.
I hate asking this, but what is your age?
62.
Okay, and you're not stopping caving anytime soon. Not
no.
That 62 is old by any means these days, but you know, you do reach a point where things start to hurt. I mean, I'm only 34, and when things started to hurt out of the blue for no reason, I noticed, and I know it's only going to get worse. You know?
Yeah, in my mind, I'm still 18, and maybe mentally too. I don't know, but yeah, I just keep having that mentality, and just keep going caving with the same folks, and we all provide energy for each other, and so it's worked out. I'm still in pretty decent shape, and I can keep up with the youngsters.
What was your first cave?
Beely's Cave in Jennings County,
Indiana. So you're,
yes,
a Hoosier, born and bred.
Correct.
Yeah, I don't know if I've heard of that one.
Yeah, that's a very nice, maybe a 3,000-foot-long cave that has water running through it with a lot of potholes, walking, very nice. And Steve Nelson, who passed 5 or 6 years ago, one of my good friends, got me involved in caving and asked me if I'd be interested in going on a trip, and changed my whole life. Once I entered that first cave, I was hooked and completely changed everything I'd worked for over the years.
From the first trip?
from the very first trip.
You were hooked.
I was.
How long, do you remember how long that trip was? Or just a little short trip?
Yeah, it was probably 3 hours. And then I would cave once a month, roughly, for the first year. And then it became to where I was caving every weekend, you know. in the early 80s, I think one year we had 35 trips to tag from Indiana. And so those are weekend trips out of 52. So,
wow.
You know, which is Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
that's a good drive, you know.
Wow. That's commitment. That's like, that's more than every other weekend.
Oh, I know. It was.
And if you don't count like the colder months, that's pretty much every weekend.
Yep. And Wow. Yeah, Danny Dibel was the one I would go with on almost all those trips, you know. So we caved a heck of a lot together. Probably saw over 1,000 caves together in our first 3 or 4 years of caving together.
Wow.
And still go caving with him. He's another great, great caver. First, second recipient, maybe, or first of Caver of the Year years ago. So
I got to hang out with him at Capers. I was glad to see him. He looks completely different from last time I saw him. He grew out that beard.
Oh, yeah.
He was nearly unrecognizable, but then someone introduced me to him. I'm like, I know Danny. Oh, hey, how's it going? You know, it was good to see him. So Billy gave you the bug. And you've been going ever since. If you hear about a cave trip or a project or something like that, is there anything about said project that would make you think, I don't really want to do that. I don't want to waste my time. Or are you pretty much up for anything?
I'd probably be up for anything. I guess if it just kind of depends where the caving area is, or certain areas I would prefer to go caving in Indiana. Being down south, maybe in Harrison and Crawford would be my number one picks for things. But no, it's pretty much open. If I'm invited, I would probably go on any trip. And
what would you say are some of your proudest accomplishments as far as finding caves? Because I know you've done a lot. You've done ridge walking, you've done survey, you've done project. You know, so you've found a lot of stuff. You've been in a lot of virgin passage. What would you say is some of the coolest stuff that you've found?
I think probably to mind would be the Marengo breakthrough was one of my happier moments.
You were there for that.
Yes. Huh. Yeah. We were coming back from a weekend trip, and I believe it was Gary Roberson asked if we would be interested in doing some chemical persuasion in an area beyond blowing bat crawl in Marengo. And so we had 7 or 8 people there, and a couple of them, it was getting late. It was Sunday night. Everybody had to work the next day. And so a few of them left, and we actually broke through within 3 or 4 hours and were standing up and walking trunk passage and ran back to get the others, and they had already left. So,
oh man,
we were in till about 6 in the morning, and I missed work the next day, but I wouldn't trade it for anything, because it was a mile and a half of big booming, some of the best passage in Indiana. So that was one that I can think of.
That's incredible. I didn't know you were there. That was a big deal at the time.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it's a great cave. It added quite a bit of mileage onto the system. And trying to think, some of the Mexico stuff maybe. And, yeah. And with Danny, we've done a lot of ridge walking down in Tag and found, you know, like Rawhide Horror Hole. We found and explored that. That's like 13 drops. One of the deeper caves in the state, over 600 and some feet deep. And,
wow.
But we found probably 5 or 6 multi-drop caves, the Norseman Well and Ain't No Cave, and those were all great times, though, including working in Wyandotte Cave and the connection into Easter. And I was luckily involved in some of the later trips in there, not the early trips, but
and that's so crazy, because you would think that an historic cave like Wyandotte Cave has been pushed to its limit.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
It was an Easter pit that Joe Oliphant and Danny and Ted Wilson had all worked on, and Glenn Lemaster. And so we connected it from the other side, and about 3 miles added on. And then they bolted the dome in there and connected it into Wyandotte. And I wasn't on the connection trip, but it was still great being in there. We had, quite a few weekend trips in there to where we'd go in and camp and map all weekend and explore.
So you were on the Dewey connection to Binkley as well, right?
Correct.
Was that the video that I saw with the muddy handshake?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
That was great. That was a big deal.
Yeah, it was really nice, especially, we had over a mile of cave and we worked really hard. We had 5 weekends of digging just to get in to the decent stuff, if you can call it that. But there was 3 of us that went in the Dewey side, and there was a whole bunch of people because on the Binkley side they were in the a couple different areas trying to anticipate where we would come out, and we used the map overlay and what we had surveyed to figure it out where we were possibly going to connect in at. And we had smoke bombs and noisemakers and all that, and we were only like 15 feet away. It was amazing. It was the easiest thing I've ever been a part of, I think.
It was still a big deal, though. What? Here's a weird question, and I'm sure picking from definitely hundreds, potentially thousands of cave trips, what is some of the most fun you've had on a cave trip? They're all fun. But is there anything that sticks out in your mind like, man, that was great? Either you found something cool or it was just the perfect combination of great friends in the right place.
Well, we had a Ellison's trip last year, and we've had a through the mountain trip where, you go down one of the deep pits and climb out the other, and a crossover trip. And mm-hmm. So we had a couple groups of people. We had a crossover trip in there, and it was with all these accomplished cavers, all friends, and just
is this with Joe Kinder?
Joe Kinder, yeah.
Yeah. And a few other people that you and I know, but yeah, that was a who's who of Indiana caving, and there were some tag people involved too.
Yeah, it was just a really a fun trip, and Elliot Stahl led the way for us.
Yeah.
And it was a real long trip. It shouldn't have been, but we were just taking a lot of pictures and just having fun. And it was just one that, I really enjoyed. It was not hard.
It wasn't to accomplish any goal other than just doing the trip. It was just essentially by your standard, and you and Joe and everybody involved on that trip are up to a high standard. But by anyone else's standard, it'd be an ass kicker. But for you guys, it was a recreational trip.
Well, it was a tourist trip. I mean, we still all felt it. It was I think 13, 14 hours.
It was a big day.
Yeah.
It was a big day.
Big day. But yeah, it was a good time. We also had a CIG trip to Norseman Wells, and I hadn't been back there since the early to mid 80s, and actually led a trip in there with my wife, Valerie, and then Joe and Rusty Riley, Joe Kinder, and it was just, and Bart Bridge. And it was just a really a fun recreational trip. Wet, very wet, and exciting. And I had forgotten how great the cave is.
you mentioned your wife, who you met at the 1992 NSS convention, right?
Correct. Yep.
Also a Hoosier?
She is. She's from Valparaiso. Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. Yep. So you wouldn't have crossed paths were it not for caving.
That's true. Yeah, she cut her teeth with Don Paulquette and Frank Lamb and Joe Ellen. So down in Bloomington, because she's an IU grad. So
wow, nice. Yeah. So that was a big thing that caving brought you.
Oh yeah,
your family
very
life.
Great. Very great. Yeah.
Oh, you've mentioned Mexico. So maybe I've got the answer to this question already. What's the farthest you've traveled to go caving?
Yeah, I would say southern Mexico.
Say it's Mexico?
Yeah. I've never really been out of the country other than Mexico, so I have nothing to tout as far as European caving or anything of that nature, or China karst or any of that. But there's some great caves in Mexico, and there's a lot to be found, and it's just going out and doing it, And,
yeah.
So I think I've had 10 or 11 expedition type trips down there. They're usually 2 to 4 weeks long at a time, and We like finding original things and mapping and exploring new stuff, and so we've been pretty successful.
Those trips down to Mexico, I mean, they're real butt kickers. I mean, you guys are climbing up mountains and finding whatever you can find, but also hacking your way through jungle essentially and dealing with local politics in order to get to places and get out of places.
Yeah, I mean, that's more than half the battle. It's just getting to the cave, you know.
Yeah.
And Tony Akers and Terry Raines and some of these other folks have really paved the way as far as being able to negotiate our way around Mexico and through the politics, you know.
Yeah.
They've both done a great job, and I've been lucky enough to go on trips with those guys. So,
talk about what the project does for the locals. I mean, obviously you guys find the caves and so that's what you get out of it, but you also make it worthwhile for the locals in the areas where you're going.
Yeah, you know, we have programs to where we try to distribute school supplies to the kids and clothes, shoes, things like that. Educate them also on the caves. I mean, I know a lot of them feel like, well, you know, they think that, you know, we're down there stealing gold, of course. and that's, I don't know how prevalent that is anymore as far as a belief, but it has been in the past.
Oh, what's your longest vertical drop? Would you say it's Golondrinas? Have you been down there?
Yeah, I've been to Golondrinas before. Probably El Sotno. It's a little deeper than Golondrinas. It's maybe a 1,400 foot or
oh,
so.
Really?
Yeah. And it's almost like rappelling into a big canyon, you know. It's so big and wide. It's not as nice as Golondrinas because Golondrinas, you're pretty much free.
Mm-hmm.
It bells out. But El Sotno, Del Barro, is kind of like a wall drop part of the way.
Mm.
Did that in 91. We had a great trip with Ron Adams and Chris Yeager and Henry Gilsdorf, Joe Oliphant. And we went down there, and we were there for 30 days, and I think we did around 12,000 vertical feet of caving. I kind of added up all the drops. Terry Raines took us on the first trip that we went down there on that 1991 episode, and we went to Purificacion. And so that is about a 904-meter deep cave, and it only has two drops in it. And so the lower entrance is the Infernillo Resurgence, and it is like 100 foot up a cliff face, and it's a massive, gigantic horizontal entrance that water would just shoot out in wet weather. Well, we climbed up that and started our way from the bottom out the top, and we spent 3 days. We had a couple camps in there, and we only did the two drops in there. They're only 25 or 30 feet. The rest are all climb-ups for the 3,000-some feet of climb-ups. And Terry did a great job leading the way. Then the next trip we had was in Bourbollon, and that's another deep cave. I think it's about 675 meters or so. It's 25 rope drops, and we went and rigged that thing to the bottom with our team and back out in one trip of 24 hours or something. And the second, Lord. First or second drop in there is about a 700 footer or so. Almost bitted in there. I had a rig pull out of the wall and I fell about 15 feet and was tumbling end over end. And right before I went over the edge of a 70 foot drop, the rope caught.
Oh my
and
God.
And it ripped the sheath off, but the core was still there, held me, but I had a pretty bad bruise on my rear, about the size of a soccer ball.
And from that point, you were how many hours from being done?
That was in the beginning of the trip. And
and you had to slog through the rest of the 24 hours?
I manned up and made it to the bottom and then back out. Just kept moving so you don't get stiff, you know.
Yeah.
But I thought, man, I didn't come all the way down here to cry and sit over here and lick my wounds. I'm going to the bottom of this thing. So
caver's caver.
Yeah.
Not just the physical pain and injury of that, but just the getting past the mental fear, I think, of, oh my God, something bad almost just happened. And now I've got all this to go. I don't know if I would have been able to do it.
Yeah.
But I guess you just got to, like you said, man up and do it.
Yeah, I just thought, you know, I came all the way down here. I'm not gonna give up on this. So,
is there a cave you can look back on and say, I don't want to go back there? I don't care to ever do that again.
Yeah, there's probably a few that
either just too small or too sleazy. You know, you want to name names?
There was a couple that I did maybe out of stupidity when I was younger. When I moved to Huntsville, Alabama, in the early 80s, so I could be closer to caving, I would try to go caving after work on the weeknights, and so I'd do pits by myself, which isn't good, and I would leave a note on my dash, and I did this pit near Huntsville. I think it was called Chris Pit. It was like a 130-foot pit, and I almost didn't make it out of there by myself. There was rocks falling, and it was really dangerous, a lot of loose stuff in there. And, so I probably would never want to go back to that one again, but, and then a couple others that, either they're, we've had some bad air in a couple caves. Mm-hmm. But really, no, not really. I think most caves I'd go back if there's some reason to go back to, you know.
Sure. I've never experienced bad air. Do you know it when you're there, or does it take a while?
Well, actually we've had some in Binkley. It's more like CO2. We had some in Sotonito de Alicatlan in Mexico. It's a 900-foot in-cave drop, and it's about 15 feet in diameter all the way down the pit. So, I mean, when rocks start falling, they bounce off the walls, and by the time they come to the bottom, they're almost powder, you know, because they just break up. But went down there first, and I thought, well, light a candle, because it's basically one down, one up. There's no place to hide at the bottom. So you're down this terrible shotgun tube thing, and couldn't get my lighter to light a candle.
Oh,
and then I finally gave up, started climbing. I got maybe 50 feet off the floor, and I was huffing and puffing like, and then I realized there isn't any air down here. That's no wonder I can't get my lighter going. So
terrifying.
Yeah, so that's it. And Binkley had some of the same stuff when we were going on the connection trip. We couldn't get a lighter to work, or, you know, everybody's breathing hard, and it's just a CO2 trap for some reason.
Let's go back to where you talked about moving to Huntsville, Alabama, to be closer to the cave. So you moved your whole life to be closer to better deep caves.
Correct. Yeah, I just happened to go down there on a vacation. And I thought I'd look for a job. I was a mechanic back then, and I was not committed to anybody or anything. And I went to a Huntsville Grotto meeting, and I found a job while I was there and a roommate. And I lived with Hal Bridges, who worked in Tullahoma for the Space Center.
Yeah, yeah.
And lived with him for a while, and they were all really hospitable, and just had a great time while I was down there. But I just had a hard time making ends meet, the Yankee down there. So
how long were you down there?
It was like 4 or 5 months.
Oh, wasn't that?
And I moved back. Yeah, I moved back.
I was going to ask what brought you back, but just, you know, life.
Yeah,
life brought you back home.
Life. Yeah.
So what is your current profession?
Engineer.
Oh, okay. Did you go? You said you were a mechanic then. At that point, did you go back to school, or
yeah.
Did you just?
Yeah, I went to a technical school to be a mechanic, and then I did that for maybe 7 years, and I thought, I'm not going to do this the rest of my life. So I went to school at night, worked full-time, went to school at night. Took me like 12 years to get my bachelor's.
Oh, wow, yeah. You did it then.
And did it. So I've been, and I work for a aerospace composites place right now, doing tooling and that kind of thing. So I got a few years left in me, I guess, but I'm ready to retire.
I bet you are. Once you do, I mean, you're in pretty good shape right now. If you do it right, retirement's somewhat around the corner. Do you see more caving in your retirement?
Yeah, I surely hope so. I want to be like Marion Smith, you know. I want to keep on caving until I'm in my 70s or 80s if I can, as long as I can go, you know.
Have you ever looked into, like, buying a cave or moving somewhere where there's more caves, like moving to southern Indiana, or you just think you're going to stick around here and make the drives?
No, I think my wife and I would like to maybe move to a warmer place. Like, I like Tennessee a lot,
sure.
You know. I don't know if it's would be to be caving, but just a change of scenery. We have a lot of friends here too, so, you know, it'd be a shame, but we'd still see them all the time caving, I guess. So I have two daughters, 15 and 17, and so it won't be too long, and, you know, we might be exploring those options.
So caving is something that you and your wife do. Have you gotten your daughters into it to any degree?
Yeah, they've been caving since they were babies.
Okay.
They've been, I think we took them up to Butler Point in Wyandotte when we used to have access to the cave. And
not really the case anymore.
No, unfortunately. But it was a good run while we had it. And but yeah, I carried the one. She was like 6 months old.
And, no kidding.
Yeah. And
that's
the other.
Great.
So, but they've done Storm's Pit as the deepest pit they've done, which is about a 70-foot drop. But
yeah.
They're not head over heels on caving because they're caught up in what most girls are caught up in these days. And but maybe they'll come back to it one of these days. They still like camping and the outdoors. So,
well, that's good. That's good, at least.
Yeah.
This is a weird question. Do you have a favorite piece of caving gear?
Oh, well, maybe just some of my older stuff. Like I think I have a sawed off Skipper flashlight that I actually engineered a bracket onto, and it stuck out like a gun barrel out of my helmet. It was ridiculous. Some of that old stuff I just have to sit back and laugh at when I look at, but it was an attempt for an electric light that was waterproof.
Yeah.
Back in the late 70s, but stuff like that, nothing other.
Just kind of fun jerry rigged stuff that you kind of just had to figure out before they started making stuff that worked really well.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Because times have changed. I mean, there's stuff now that you can just buy, but you used to have to kind of make it yourself.
That's right. Yep.
Do you have a, would you say you have a favorite cave?
Well, you know, Wyandotte is one of my very favorite caves. There's just so much history to it. It's such an awesome cave. And I can feel the Native Americans when I'm in there just walking. And, you know, because they walk through there, you know, and it's just, and then all my great memories of going in Wyandotte and Easter Pit Cave. It's just my favorite cave, I think.
Are there any other caves that do that for you where you can kind of feel that sort of spiritual presence kind of like you do at Wyandotte? Because I've felt that too. I mean, hell, I feel that sometimes just going through Buckner, which everyone's been through. And it's not so much a Native American thing as it is just a slice of humanity thing where everybody's been in there in their best and in their worst ways. And it's just like, man, everyone's been through here. People used to sign their name over here. They've sandblasted it off now, but this used to be the spot, you know? Are there any other caves that do that for you?
Well, you know, just some of the caves that you get so remote in, Fisher Ridge, Roppel Cave, some caves down in Tag that you're not getting out for hours, even if you want to, you know? It's going to take a monumental amount of effort and time to get out, but when you get way back in there, or even in Mexico on a extended underground camp, you know, you do feel a kind of a spiritual sense about the cave and how remote you are. And it's a cool feeling. It probably freaks some people out to be like, they call it rapture of the deep, but I've been lucky. I haven't really got that before, but it's more of a spiritual thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that that's a testament to your psyche, because I would say that you and people like you, there's something about your brain that just allows you to do that more so than so many other people who would just freak out if they found themselves in some of these situations.
Yeah, I think it's working your way up to it, too, with all the caves over the years. You know, you've seen just about every kind of, you know, scenario usually, and I think that helps mold your brain or recircuit yourself.
Can you think of a situation back in the early days of caving where you were met with sort of a mental challenge and it sort of ended up defining your caving life later? Like, wow, I got to this point, kind of almost freaked out, but I pushed through. Can you look back and see that point and think, okay, that's how I got to where I am?
Yeah, I think, well, caving with Danny for so many years, you know, he is a diehard as far as wanting to throw in the towel. He'll stick it out till the very bitter end in any cave. And so many times in the early days, I'm like, I want out of here, you know, and he's not ready.
That's the last thing from his mind.
So I'm just kind of waiting and we're hanging around. And
But I think the older you get tougher mentally, and that's probably where my weakest point was, is my mental attitude about caving in the earlier days. But I feel like it's pretty decent these days.
I hope you don't mind if we talk about this, but you were involved in the December rescue last year of some of our friends in Binkley Cave.
Yes.
So you and our friend Joe found out about this fairly early on before the media had gotten a hold of it. And you made a drive down there in sleet, and you drove as fast as you could all the way down there. I guess just kind of walk through when you got the call and what you were feeling, and then how the rest of it ended up resolving.
Well, I was at my my family has a Christmas get-together every year, and so all of my seven younger brothers and sisters and their families, we were all together enjoying Christmas, and I'd been had a few beers and eaten, and I got a call from Gary Robertson, and he had said that he was very worried, and he normally doesn't sound as worried as he did because of all the rain that we had got, and our friends, seven of them, were in Binkley, and they were going to an area that is not a good place to be if it rains. So we talked to a couple other people, and we just kind of hung around and waited. So we had really bad weather, too. So once we finally left, it was around midnight, and we got there at 5 a.m., and it took 5 hours from Indy in the ice, and the roads were terrible.
Normally, it's what, it's two and a half, three-hour drive,
yep.
Wow.
So Joe drove, and we got down there, and Brad had already been there, Brad and Goni, and they had set up a stick in there to try to measure the water, and this is down in the historic. But then they went to a hotel to sleep because the water was continuing to rise. And so Joe and I just hung out outside the entrance, and about every hour we would go down in there and see how much the water had gone up or hopefully gone down. And then by maybe 9 or 10 o'clock, the water was still rising. And by 1 o'clock, I think it had started to drop by maybe 2 inches an hour or something. And so by the end of the day, we were felt pretty good that, you know, we could mount a group to go in. And so Joe and I were part of the first team in. We went in with Shane Miles and Tim Pride, I believe, and we all went to the big room, and then they continued on from there. Our assignment, Joe's and mine, was to go into the mountain room there and see if they might be there. If they weren't, we were to turn around and report back to them so they knew what was going on, and then the other three guys would continue on farther into the cave to see if they could find them.
At this point, the operation was kind of being run by Anmar,
yes, yeah. And Don, and then the DNR was there also, and they were providing assistance as much as they could, and they were great too. So the water was very deep, though. I could barely touch the floor, and normally it's like knee to ankle deep water through there, but it was up to my neck, and at times I was swimming, and so was Joe, and coming back out after we went to the room was pretty challenging because you were going against the current coming in, and you're just trying to grab onto the mud bank walls to help pull yourself forward because your feet, I was on my tiptoes, and I could barely touch and keep my neck out of my chin out of the
water. You're a fairly tall guy. You're what, 6'1"?
6'1", yeah. So, but yeah, I was exhausted. It was only about a 3-hour deal to go in and back out, but it was really cold water because it was about 4 degrees out too, so, and the air sucking into the cave. Yeah, so that just kind of, that was the very beginning, and
it had to have been just on your mind the whole time, my friends are in there.
It was horrible. Yeah, I just couldn't, I kept picturing all of them drowned, you know. And
yeah,
I mean,
how could that not flash in your mind as a possibility?
Yeah, I just tried not to think about it, but I kept thinking, you know, I don't want to see that,
no.
You know, and we prayed a heck of a lot, you know, and actually after about 30 some hours, you know, and we're working, you know, we got there, I guess it was Saturday night. You know, we didn't sleep for like a couple of days, Joe and I couldn't sleep. I tried to sleep in the car and I just couldn't, you know, maybe.
No, how could you?
squeeze an hour off or so. And but it was after about 35 or 38 hours, you know, then we got word that they had actually found them. We were trying to get some rest so we could go back in. They wanted us to go back in. The fire department had cleaned all of our wetsuits and dried them and got them all ready. And I had no idea that's why they wanted us to go back in there again. But
So when you found out that they were alive, you must have just been beside yourself.
That was one of the best feelings I've ever had in my life, you know, just knowing, you know, that everybody was okay. And yeah, I just couldn't believe it, really.
Just a big, deep breath out. Thank God.
Yeah, it was really strange, too, because, you know, I had a really hard time adjusting after that rescue. I was depressed for a couple of days, and I didn't know why. You know, I had no reason to be depressed, you know, but somebody told me that we were just running on adrenaline for so much of that time. And then finally, once you get some sleep, then there's that depression that sets in, you know.
Interesting. But,
yeah, it was weird. I think Joe experienced the same thing, and probably a lot of the other people involved, the people that were in there and the people that, you know, went in to help them out, because they were pretty much on their way. You know, they were very experienced, of course, and they probably could have made it quite a few more hours in there. You know, that's what kept them alive, is just their experience and knowledge and how they prepared for the trip, you know.
Yeah, it couldn't have happened to a more prepared group, you know. They knew what they were doing. And there had to have been a part of you that knew that as well. Like, they wouldn't get themselves into too much trouble. I mean, they didn't see this rain event coming, but if anyone would know how to stay safe from it, they would know.
Yeah, there's the crawl that they were going through was like your back's on the ceiling, your chest is on the floor, and it's about 300 feet before it breaks into a bigger area back there. And if they were in that when the water started coming up, then they wouldn't have had a chance. Well, it turns out they were in there when that water started coming up, and they got through part of it, and then they realized that the water was coming up, and they were able to turn around and head back out. Some of them hadn't even entered that crawl yet. So, because if they would have been back in there and that thing would have sunk shut for 300 feet, I don't know if they would be around today.
No.
I just, you know, there was a lot of luck and somebody watching out for them. So,
yeah, I'm glad you were there, and I'm glad so many other people were there, and I'm glad that they knew what they were doing.
Me too. Yep.
Is there anything else you want to cover?
No, I just, you know, I've been really fortunate to cave with some great people, and, you know, got to do a lot of good caving in Kentucky also, Antag, Mexico, and I wouldn't change a thing from how it's gone from the beginning, and I'm very happy and hope to keep caving. So,
is there anything still on your list? Like, I got to go there?
Oh yeah, I got there's always things on your list. There's so many things in TAG that I haven't done that's been discovered since I was really active down there.
You've been to Lechuguilla?
Yes, yeah.
You have?
I went in 1988 or
so. Oh wow, that was right after they broke in, huh?
Yeah, I think it was about 40 miles long then. Jim Smith, TAG caver and Mexico caver, and I went down there for a 1 week vacation in the quads, and our first trip in there was in Lechuguilla. And of course, because of his ties, he got a really good trip, and I got a decent trip. It was to the Chandelier Maze area, you know, but was with Carol Vesely and some pretty decent cavers also, you know, and so that was a real eye-opener. It was a 28-hour trip with no sleep, and then we got to do some stuff in the quads, too. That was great. So some nice virgin pit, 600-foot drop there, and some other nice stuff. So it was fun to go with Jim. He's a good, great guy. The never really caved up. I've been in the commercial caves, the Wind and Jewel, but never done any really wild caving up in that part.
In that corner of South Dakota where there's no caves in the whole state except for that little corner.
Yeah. And did some caving in Coldwater Cave, which was really cold water. It's about 40 degree water or something. And
you wonder, some of the caves, you wonder how they get their name, and then some, it's just obvious. All right. Yeah. Right, I get it. There wasn't a lot of creativity going on here.
Yeah, that's a really nice cave too, though. 16 miles plus long, and a lot of big stuff in there. But Yeah, there's just so many great caves. I see all these international cavers with their posts from China and all these places. And, of course, I'd love to go there, but I got to wait till my kids are, you know, a little older before I can just take off. And I think Val, my wife, is maybe looking for maybe some non-caving traveling to do in the future. So something a little more relaxing and enjoyable.
Well, at least she's a caver and you got that together. But, you know, everybody needs a break every once in a while.
Oh, yeah. 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 We'll have fun regardless of where we go. So.
Well, Greg McNamara, thank you so much for being on the Caving Podcast. Congrats on Caver of the Year. And here's to more trips in the future.
Well, thanks, Matt. Appreciate you having me. And just thrilled to be a part of the CIG and the NSS. And keep on caving.
What a guy. And what a storied caving life. Thanks, Greg. And thank you for listening. New episodes come out on the first of every month, and next month I have former Binkley Cave project leader and Lou Bicking Award recipient Dave Everton on the podcast. Looking forward to closing out 2017 with a good one in Dave Everton. Can't wait. If you'd like to email me, you can do that at alpineproductions@gmail.com. alpineproductions@gmail.com. As always, support the show by supporting our sponsors, Organic Robot on Etsy, Swago at swagogear.com, or directly on Patreon at patreon.com/cavingpodcast. I'm Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto, saying join your local grotto, join the NSS, or renew your membership, or just kick an extra donation their way if you can. And as always, kill nothing but time.